From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, opera legend Plácido Domingo is accused of sexually assaulting and harassing a number of women. Then Mads Brügger, the director of a documentary about the mysterious death of the UN Secretary General in 1961, his film spirals from there into even crazier territory.
The very idea of killing off the Secretary General of the UN sounds ludicrous. It would be like killing off the Pope. But the crime scene was the perfect kill room.
And how a little-known LA band scored an invite to open for the Rolling Stones. All that coming up on The Frame. Today, the Associated Press published a story that alleges opera superstar Plácido Domingo sexually assaulted and harassed 9 female artists over several decades. The LA Opera, where Domingo has served as general director since 2003, says it will launch an investigation into the allegations. Domingo is not scheduled to perform with the company until next year. The reaction to the news across the country was dramatic. The Philadelphia Orchestra already has canceled a performance by the Three Tenors alumnus at its upcoming season opening gala. The San Francisco Opera has canceled an October concert that was to mark the 50th anniversary of Domingo's debut with that company. And New York's Metropolitan Opera says it will await the results of the LA investigation before taking any action. Domingo is scheduled to perform Macbeth there next month. Peggy McGlone is an arts reporter at the Washington Post. She's written about sexual harassment in the world of classical music. And we talked about the pressure Domingo's alleged victims felt. If they complained or didn't submit to him, their careers would suffer.
That is the dynamic, the worry that that you have to make a choice. That it's not just a, you know, getting out of an uncomfortable situation, but that your, you know, future work is in peril.
It feels like this is a little bit like Harvey Weinstein, that a lot of people kind of knew it might have been happening and they couldn't stop it. Is that your impression as well?
I think this is, to anybody that we've talked to today and, you know, in recent months, it's one of those open secrets where, the rumors, people who know people, but very hard to pin it down.
I want to ask you about some reporting that The Washington Post has today. You spoke to a singer named Cynthia Weinman, who is part of the Washington National Opera Young Artist Program, and she talks about a flight to China for a production of Rigoletto, and that everybody on the plane kind of knew what was happening. And she said in your story, "We all pretended nothing was happening. I think it created a culture of it being accepted in that company." Is that limited to opera and Plácido Domingo, or is it something that happens throughout classical music?
Well, she was speaking in reference to that, you know, couple of years in that training program, young artist training program, that there was, you know, a well-known sexual relationship and everybody just sort of went about their business and that sort of gave permission to others, she felt, to behave in similar ways. I know that last year, Anne Majette and I did a major report where we spoke with, you know, 4 dozen musicians, and we heard that quite a bit, this sort of idea that there's a culture of, you know, when the people at the top are misbehaving and are harassing and there's no one to turn to, it becomes, you know, acceptable across the board.
Have you seen classical institutions change the way they respond to these allegations? Because as you mentioned, you and your colleague wrote about sexual harassment in the classical music world. We've had other people like James Levine at the Metropolitan Opera who have been accused of abuse. Are the institutions changing how they're behaving?
Right. Well, you know, I think that's a case-by-case basis, and I think it'll take a little while to learn. Last year, when we reported about William Prussell in the Cleveland Orchestra, that organization immediately launched an investigation, and after several months, not only did they come back with findings against Prussell, but against another musician who we had also, you know, had heard reports of, but weren't able to get it airtight for our report. But then they also fired him. So that, and they put all of their investigation and their reports online for all to see. So the LA Opera today announced very quickly that they were going to hire outside investigators to look into this and that they take it very seriously. So I guess, you know, only time will tell.
I guess one of the issues is as well that you have a union like the American Guild of Musical Artists, and William Prussell is both represented by that union, as are the accused. Is that an issue as well?
And that's yes. And there's some issues there too. You know, we saw in New York with you know, some ballet dancers where the accused and the victims were, you know, both being represented by the same people, and it can get difficult.
We're talking with Peggy McGlone, a reporter with the Washington Post, about Placido Domingo. I want to ask you about the legend and power of Placido Domingo. The Associated Press story has one victim saying, quote, "I was totally intimidated and felt like saying no to him would be saying no to God." How do you say no to God? How powerful was Placido Domingo?
It's absolutely true, right, that these are people who can hire young artists, who can help launch a career, who can introduce them to other people that, you know, who might hire them. And then the corollary to that is that they can then also ignore them. And, you know, promised roles dry up and, you know, suggest, you know, help getting another job doesn't happen. And then all of a sudden you're sort of, as these women in the story today point out, you know, you're just saying to yourself, what happened? Did I just ruin my career?
I want to ask you one last thing about what Placido Domingo said in his defense. I'm quoting his own statement to the AP now. He says, "I recognize that the rules and standards by which we are and should be measured against today are very different than they were in the past." And I'm also going to read you what Harvey Weinstein said when allegations against him came out 2 years ago. "I came of age in the 60s and 70s when all the rules about behavior and workplaces were different. That was the culture then. I have to say, there was never a time where sexually assaulting anybody was permissible." But does that get at the heart of the issue here, that he thought he could maybe get away with it?
Right. Or maybe the difference is, and these men are not articulating it. We heard similar things in our major report last year. The difference is maybe women are being believed, and that's where the fulcrum has changed.
After the Harvey Weinstein story came out, there were other allegations about a number of prominent people in Hollywood and in television. Is it your sense that this could be the tip of the iceberg, not only as it relates to Placido Domingo, but do you feel that there might be other people in the classical music world who are going to have their day of reckoning?
You know, that is an interesting question, and we've been working on this. You know, very impressed by the reporting in this AP story today. My colleague Amajet and I have spent a couple of years on it. There's still a lot of stories out there that we hear repeatedly. So, you know, we're interested and we're trying, but it's also, you know, it's serious work, and you have to be very careful.
Peggy McGlone is an arts reporter with the Washington Post. Peggy, thank you for your time and coming on the show.
Oh, thank you.
Coming up on The Frame, a documentary about the plane crash death of the UN Secretary General turns into a crazy tale of conspiracies and worse. Danish journalist and filmmaker Mads Brügger is known for taking on complicated and controversial topics for his documentaries, all with a gonzo journalistic style that comes off like a mix between Werner Herzog and Hunter S. Thompson. His latest film, Cold Case Hammarskjöld, is no different. It begins as an investigation into the 1961 death of UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld, whose plane crashed in what is now Zambia. But the mystery of his death is just the beginning to a film that turns into a crazy tale of conspiracies and genocide plots. Let's just say that this 10-minute radio segment will struggle to contain it all. Hammarskjöld's death is believed by some to be the result of pilot error, but Brügger strongly suggests there could be another explanation.
During his reign, he was very active in Africa, traveling all over Africa, meeting with leaders of newly independent countries, and he saw the UN as a protector of these newly independent countries from their old colonial masters, which, of course, made him unpopular in certain circles in France and the UK, and also with white people in places such as Rhodesia and South Africa. Dag Hammarskjöld was considered, you know, by certain key players in all of this, a problem and a nuisance. Of course, you know, the very idea of killing off the Secretary General of the UN sounds ludicrous. It would be like killing off the Pope. But if you were to pull it off at that point in time, the crime scene was the perfect kill room. Almost immediately, there were whispers, rumors about a possible attempt to bring the plane down. And even more so today, where it is, you know, considered more or less... It was fishy business.
A lot of people have investigated what happened to his plane, including the United Nations. And I'm wondering, did you think that their investigations weren't complete? Did you have an angle? In other words, what was your motivation in trying to solve a case that a lot of people have looked into and I guess haven't yet been able to solve?
Most importantly for me is my sidekick in the film, who is a private Swedish researcher named Björn Björkdahl, who has been tracking down the remaining black witnesses who were living near the crash site back in 1961. They tell a very different story from the official version. What they tell is, I think, you know, very decisive in the investigation which is ongoing now in the UN. And also because more than 50 years have passed, so archives are opening up. Secret documents are being declassified, and people who are still in the know are at an age today where they are not afraid about spilling the beans.
There's a moment in the film where you are with a shovel and a metal detector near the site of where the plane went down.
It's a bit like in films when people have to dig their own grave. I just need a time out, Jørgen. Huh? I'm about to be throwing up.
Oh, Jesus.
And it strikes me as almost a kind of comedic device because, honestly, you're not really going to find the cause of the plane crash with your shovel and your metal detector, or are you? What are you trying to accomplish in that scene?
Well, it is a sort of a MacGuffin because, as you also say, you know, the odds of us getting to the heart of the matter, actually, you know, digging up the wreckage, is very minute. It actually came as a surprise to me when the airport security manager says, you know, that we can begin digging in a field in the middle of the airport next to the runway. Not that many, you know, airport security managers would green light something like that.
Yeah, although we should say he's quickly overruled by his superior, but yes.
He is, yes. But no, it is a MacGuffin, but also, you know, a sort of a metaphor about the quest we are on and a metaphor on looking for truth, uncovering dark secrets from history and so forth.
There are so many interesting characters that you interview and feature in this documentary, but I would argue none more interesting or complicated than you yourself. And I'm wondering, when you're thinking about what it's like to film yourself or include yourself in your own documentary, who is that person? Is that you? Is it a kind of a heightened version of Mads Brügger? How would you describe the person that we're seeing, and what is it like to actually film yourself in your own movie?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it. You know, in Danish we have a saying which is, if you stick out your behind or your bum, your temperature will get taken. And so it's risky business, you know, being in your own film. But for me, you know, and the reason why I often do so is, you know, I appreciate the honesty in showing yourself in the film, is instead of being the proverbial, you know, fly on the wall. There is an honesty in it, which I enjoy and I find important.
We're talking with Mads Brügger about his documentary, Cold Case Hammarskjöld. I want to play another clip from the film, and this gets to the kind of bigger idea of what you find and whether or not what you find is to be believed. This is a man named Alexander Jones, not to be confused with the U.S. propagandist Alex Jones. And he says he used to work for a secret organization in South Africa called the South African Institute for Maritime Research, and that they had a part in Dag Hammarskjöld's death.
Were they taking orders from South African military? Or
no, I think our main orders came from the British government. That's my opinion.
The British government?
Yeah. Well, from our British handlers, controllers, whatever. To this day, I still believe that we were a subunit of some British entity.
There are a lot of people, Alexander Jones included, who say some very controversial and explosive things. So at what point are you chronicling or transcribing what it is they're saying? And at what point are you challenging and checking what they're saying?
Well, we did do as much as possible to corroborate what Alexander Jones claims to be true. So far, we have not, caught him telling us lies or feeding us misinformation. Of course, many of his claims are sensational, outrageous, but what we are capable of corroborating basically checks out. Most importantly for me, I clearly state in the film that Alexander Jones do not offer any kind of documentation. He does not have any documents, photographs, personal effects, which proves that he was a member of SIMR, the South African Maritime Research Institute. He is on a list of men who were recruited into SIMR. His name is on that list, which is important, I think. But at the end of the day, he has no interest in taking part in this film with his face and full name. He has no money to gain from it. There will probably be a legal aftermath for him because of this film, because, he confesses to taking part in killing people.
There's another extraordinary allegation that is in this film, and that is what role secret entities had in spreading AIDS through Africa, where it has had a devastating history in the population of Africa. And I'm wondering, as you reported that, and as other people have come behind and checked into that reporting, what kind of confidence do you have in that proposal that might have happened at that time?
It is something I have really struggled to deal with as a journalist and as a filmmaker. In the end, I decided, to have in the film what I know for sure about these heinous and horrible allegations. What we know to be true is that we learn about how the leader of SIMR, Maxwell, was running a number of clinics around Johannesburg, where he was posing as a doctor without having had any kind of medical training, where he was experimenting on black people. We have an eyewitness who saw him giving people injections there. We also have the strategy papers written by Maxwell, where he writes about using HIV, the virus, as a way to kill off black people, thereby radically altering the demographics of South Africa. And then we learn about two people who had the experience of taking part in a sinister vaccination program with the intent to infect black people with HIV. Now, if this really happened, how was it financed? What was the scientific side to it? Because at that point in time, it would require an enormously advanced laboratory. And all of this needs to be investigated, and that calls for a government agency to take action, I think, if we are to get a full closure about this alleged vaccination program. But in my mind, and most importantly, planning for it, what in essence is a black holocaust, planning for it, writing strategy papers about it, discussing it, somehow also acting out, in itself constitutes a crime, and that is why it has to be in the film.
Mads Brügger is the filmmaker behind the new documentary Cold Case Hammarskjöld. It's in theaters on August 16th. Mads, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, John.
Coming up, a little-known L.A. band on opening for the Rolling Stones. Rock bands still flock to Southern California with hopes of making it big, and sometimes a band gets a completely random break. That's what happened recently to the L.A. band called Vista Kicks. They were going about their business from their base in the Highland Park neighborhood, and then the biggest rock band in the world came calling. KPCC's Marley Feuerwerker Otto put together this story for us.
We're a band called Vista Kicks. We're from Roseville, California. We live in Highland Park now.
My name is Sam, and I play guitar and I sing.
I'm Trevor, and I play bass.
I'm Nolan, and I play drums.
My name is Derek. I'm a singer in the band and play a little guitar and piano.
We all met between ages 5 and 10. T-ball, soccer, band class. We're just passing through the halls.
She grew up down the stairs.
We funded our last album with a Kickstarter.
We thought Kickstarter would work with our name, Vista Kicks. We're an independent band and we didn't have any sort of overhead funding. We didn't think we'd make what we made. We asked for $30,000, and we were at about $8,000 about 3 days before. It was like, well, I guess we'll just do it again. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing. We're not even close. But then it happened, and it was really great for us because we could fund the album, and it got us across the pond to go on tour with the Kooks in the UK. It saved us. I mean, it saved us, totally.
Summer. Like it was yesterday, you used to call my name when I was younger.
Summer. We were on tour with the Kooks in the UK, and the manager of the Stones came to our show in London, and we met her, and we were like, wow, like, you're actually the manager of the Rolling Stones. Like, that's insane. And she's like, yeah, I really like you guys, and I would love to put you in the running for the Stones. And we were like, yeah, okay. So then we just forgot about it. And then months later, we get a call saying, like, Ronnie Woods heard your music and he likes it. And we're like, what the heck? You know, we're talking to ourselves, like, what?
Still never going to happen.
Yeah, still never going to happen. You know, Mick Jagger's heard your music and doesn't hate it.
Didn't say no.
That's a big compliment.
Yes. He's heard it. Oh, my gosh. We were driving home. We were driving to Roseville, and we're in the car. Our manager says, well, they didn't give you the Stones gig for the Rose Bowl. You know, they gave it to Gary Clark Jr. We're like, oh, well, yeah, of course. I mean, come on. We have no business doing any of this, you know? And he goes, but they did get you on the Santa Clara show. And we're like, what? We were freaking out. We went immediately home. Hung out with our parents, you know, celebrated. I mean, we're still knocking on wood. It still doesn't seem real. I think until it actually happens, we won't feel what we're supposed to feel. Maybe this is what we're supposed to feel. I don't know. I mean, for a band like us, we're independent, we're small, we've known each other our whole lives. Like, this is beyond our wildest dreams, so it's hard to take in and process.
Do you believe in magic?
We do now.
Love, give me love, give me something to believe. Squeeze me and give me what I need. Your love, more than enough. So give me your love.
We thought big for a second. We're like, well, you know, we're gonna have to hire crew because we can't go up on stage and put our amps down like any other gig. And then we really reflected on it and we said, all right, we got here doing what we're doing. We might as well just do that.
It's funny, like, even if we wanted to hire people, we don't know anybody who does stadium level.
That's not in our Rolodex.
So we're just going. It's just us.
We're going to go out there and we're going to put our little amps down and plug on in and jam, and we're going to wave, maybe even take a bow, and then we'll cart our amps off like we always do. No smoke and mirrors. You know, you're getting a Vista Kick show, even if it's at a little pub or the Levi's Stadium.
Love is in the air when my reflection isn't staring back at me.
I mean, it's one stadium gig. We haven't.
Right.
We're not. It's not. They're not our.
Time to retire.
Yeah, exactly. You can't just be like, all right, that's it.
What about my love?
Each one of us is gonna have a hot tub at our mansion.
Begging me to stay.
It's just another thing, I think, that helps keep our spirits up and the ball rolling, because it does. Times do get hard. You know, it's like the Kickstarter thing, too. It's just something that's unbelievably great.
I mean, we're always looking forward to the next record. just excited to make that next chunk of music and try to outdo ourselves and make something that we're proud of and that people that we admire would be stoked to listen to. It's always going to be that. It always has been that. Right. We just got to keep the grind.
Right.
Still just building a fan base. So,
I mean, you're never really ready for it, but we're as ready as we'll ever be. We've just been really blessed and lucky to be doing this.
We're clearly in the thick of it right now, and after playing gigs with the Rolling Stones, we're going to feel more inspired than ever to make the best music we can, because we're going to have probably more eyes on us than we've ever had.
I know I'm my own worst enemy. In my mind, I'm lost at sea.
And Vista Kicks will have a post-Rolling Stones homecoming show. It's on August 21st at the Terragram Ballroom in downtown L.A. And that's our show for today. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.